This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. A humanitarian organization whose responsibility was allegedly to distribute aid and food became another tool of war in Gaza. This is how many Palestinians describe the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF. In May of this year, after the Israeli regime stopped all other aid distribution, it allowed the U.S.-backed GHF to be the only entity inside of Gaza providing aid. Distribution points turned into death traps, and now after 6 months of operations, the foundation is suspending its work in Gaza. Many Palestinians say the organization must be held responsible for their role in weaponizing aid and its overall role in the U.S.-Israeli genocide. Here's a report.
The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, created and controlled by the United States and Israel, has announced the end of its emergency mission in Gaza. But for Palestinians, this mission was never about salvation. It was a blueprint for mass killing. According to the Gaza government media office, the foundation provided a false humanitarian cover, transforming its aid distribution centers into death traps and sites of mass killing.
And the idea is that they're a charitable organization. They're not for profit. But in this case, they're for killing. I'd just like to point out that there are 2,600 dead and injured at people who were trying to access the Gaza so-called Humanitarian Foundation's facilities.
The foundation's centers, often run by former U.S. military personnel, became theaters of execution. Witnesses describe Israeli forces opening sniper fire and artillery on hungry civilians funneled into those open areas. The locations transformed to deliberate death traps employed by Israel as tools of genocide. Despite the international condemnation, including UN officials who called the system unsafe and humiliating, the U.S. found more excuses.
Certainly nothing will be perfect. I've said this before, that it can't be perfect because it is an unnatural, obscene environment. To demand perfection or a new normal of this environment is unacceptable. Nothing will be enough.
With its withdrawal, Hamas has demanded immediate international legal action to hold to account the foundation and its American and Israeli backers.
We call upon all international human rights organizations to ensure GHF does not escape accountability after causing the death and injury of thousands of Gaza people and covering up the starvation policy practiced by the Israeli regime.
The world watched as famine was engineered, humanitarian gestures became death traps, and the people were systematically starved to death or executed. This was not a failure of aid, but a calculated strategy of genocide, facilitated by powerful nations. The empty plates and mass graves of Gaza are testament to this betrayal. The world will remember that it allowed and watched a genocide and then simply moved on.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program. Mazen Qom Sayyi, university professor, historian, and author out of Bethlehem. And Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. Well, welcome both of you to the program. I'm started off in Bethlehem. I mean, your thoughts overall about this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. We know that the United Nations, prior to GHF, was operating 400 aid sites in Gaza, and then the Israeli regime shut them down, and it was just the GHF that was on the ground with four hubs. In all of that area. So do you think that to begin with it was a formula that was set up to fail and to cause as much misery as possible, or how do you see it?
Well, I see what Israel and the U.S. are doing is basically experimenting with different techniques of torturing the people of Gaza. The acronym GHF for me stands for Genocide Hellish Foundation, as your reporters showed, basically, that thousands of people were killed in these death traps. But there are other mechanisms that Israel is using, and now, the reason they are removing this foundation and creating other mechanisms in the form of what's called green areas and red areas separated by the yellow line is another method of ethnic cleansing and genocide of the people of Gaza. So they experiment in different methodologies of destroying the people of Gaza, destroying the livelihood of Gaza. This is what they have been doing, not even since October 2023, but since May 1948, when they experimented with how to remove Palestinian villages and towns, in some cases poisoning water wells, in other cases shelling them to oblivion, in other cases scaring them or raping women and committing massacres. So they tried different techniques, but the end result that they aim for is a Palestine without Palestinians and to rename it the Jewish State of Israel. That's the original plan and has not changed.
What about that, Mick, that basically experimenting and seeing different ways of being able to torture the Palestinians, according to our guests in Bethlehem? I mean, if we look at the Zionist entity and what it has done, along with the U.S. government, would you say that the setup of this GHF not only should be, of course, blamed on the Zionists and the Americans, but the whole Western hegemonic front that allowed this entity to commit genocide and then allowed the same entity to decide who can actually distribute aid to the people that they are targeting and killing every day?
You've set us up in this program for a very difficult task, and it's to find a language to describe the horror, the depravity and the barbarism of what's being visited upon the people of Palestine. And as our other guest points out, this goes back a very, very long way. But let's try. I think that in science and in politics and in any other area of life, if you have a simple theory that explains everything, then we should use that theory. And Israel wants to kill Palestinians. Israel, I mean, Ariel Sharon was quoted by another cabinet minister as saying in a cabinet meeting that the only good Arab was a dead Arab. And that's what he said, and that's what he meant. And that was his whole history. His whole record was based on that idea. And the whole Zionist project is based on that. They would much prefer, like a Pied Piper, for the Palestinians to follow a Piper and leave Palestine. But in reality, they know they have to use overwhelming violence and full-spectrum criminality in order to achieve their goal. Their goal is, as they say to the world, to remove Palestinians from Gaza. And Donald Trump joins in to turn it into a real estate deal. But, you know, it's absolutely bestial. There is experimentation because the Zionists are strategic. The present crop of mass killers are different from earlier crops. I mean, we saw, for example, in the Great March of Return a few years ago, thousands of Palestinians maimed, industrial numbers injured and crippled, and hundreds, thousands killed over the course of that experiment by the Palestinians in peaceful demonstration, and an experiment by the Zionists in industrial scale killing in the full view of the world. And I think we have to go back to that to say, when the Israelis found out that they could do that, that they could openly in their press boast about snipers killing and maiming Palestinians, when one of them could boast in the media that he, in one shift, shattered 43 Palestinian knees with his sniper rifle. When they saw that they could get away with that, then they decided to escalate.
Okay.
Because, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing diabolical killing, full spectrum killing. And the key thing is, as you've alluded to, the Western chancelleries have not been critical. They've been silent. They have continued to send weapons. But if you think that one of the elements of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was actually, and I think if you wrote this into a novel, nobody would believe it, was a motorcycle gang, an anti-Islamic motorcycle gang with a history of provoking Muslims. But this bandit gang, this gang was hired by the Americans to man, to staff the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
Stay with me, Mick. Let me get Mazen back in on this. I mean, it's so dystopian, of course, when we think about everything that has taken place and continues to take place in Gaza. I mean, one of them is this, Mazen, your perspective, because the person that was hired to originally run this GHF was actually a former American sniper, an American sniper turned aid worker, and even he couldn't handle it more than 2 weeks. He said that it lacked basic humanitarian principles of neutrality. It is absolutely so mind-boggling when we just think about what is happening and continues to happen. I mean, your thoughts on this, Mazen?
Well, indeed, one of the people who worked for GHF eventually explained that this was the policies that were practiced. There was not about humanitarian aid, there was about control and starvation and killing, while projecting that the US and Israel care about the Palestinians, civilians in Gaza, because they were afraid of sanctions and afraid of the growing boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. So, you know, this, as I said earlier, is a form of psychological warfare and propaganda, what the Israelis called Hasbara, you know, what the Americans call Hollywood productions of actions to produce a certain result that's desired in the mainstream media of Western countries. Of course, the people of Gaza don't buy it. People around the world didn't buy it, and there was a lot of talk about it. And I think eventually that's why they closed it and end up now trying new tools or new techniques.
Right. Well, Mick, since the GHF started its distribution, so-called distribution, in May of this year, 3,000 more Palestinians were killed at those so-called distribution centers. It is outrageous. It is unbelievable. I don't even know the words that we can use for this, to even think that at a place that's supposed to be safe and distributing aid, that thousands and thousands of people were killed and thousands of others just simply humiliated and treated as if they were not human. Your thoughts about, first of all, how this was allowed, and two, that the world allowed it to happen. I mean, this is the reality. We know that there have been protests here and there and around the world, but at the bottom of the line, Palestinians are still starving to death as we speak.
I think genocides supervised by the Americans have been going on for a very, very long time. 3 million killed in Vietnam. And as a young man, I learned that they were openly scattering tiny little plastic, brightly colored little bombs across the land surface of Vietnam, specifically to be picked up by children and specifically to blow off parts of their limbs.
Right.
Not to kill them, but to overload the society, the health service, the social networks. And when I heard about this barbarism, which was not denied by anyone, was openly, not openly in the mass media on page one, but you could find it in scholarly journals. When I realized this was going on, I could never unlearn that. And you know, these genocides have been happening for a very, very long time. What's unique about the Gaza genocide, the Palestinian genocide, is that it does take place in the full glare of social media. That although Israel has killed, I'm sorry, I can't remember the number, is it 250 journalists during the last 2 years? They've killed so many journalists, but still other heroic figures are working as journalists in Palestine and Gaza today and telling that story. So it cannot be covered up. I mean, not one person in 100 knows about the Guatemala genocide, where America overthrew a democratically elected government, installed a monstrous regime which used germ warfare against their own native population. It was a genocide, and it's hardly known today. But people cannot ignore what's happening in Gaza, and they know it and they see it. And at the terrible cost that Gaza people have paid, Palestinians are paying, they have changed the consciousness of a huge chunk of the world to a degree that I find unprecedented, that this has burned deeply into people's awareness. And we see this in prime time social media. But our own governments are complicit, and they are not complicit in the sense that they're helping it. My own government is an active participant in it, so that the Royal Air Force flew over Gaza 500 times and gave intelligence to the killers on the ground. And then they admitted this in Parliament. So it's not that this is hidden. It's not that you can find out if you make an effort, which is the case with other genocides. It's that you cannot ignore it. And the full bestiality and barbarism of what's going on is really causing ripples around the world. In Britain, for example, the government has to arrest thousands of people who are protesting in support of the people of Palestine. Literally thousands are being arrested. I myself face 14 years imprisonment for solidarity activity. It's nothing, but it's nothing compared to what the Palestinians suffer. But our governments are forced into this repression. My daughter lives in Berlin. The police there are brutal. Anybody who appears in the street there with a keffiyeh or anything that signifies Palestine runs a serious risk. So it's public, it's well known, the governments know it, and they're using repression to try to sustain their support for the genocide.
Right. Well, Mazen, I mean, with the GHF, when Monday it announced that it's going to be suspending its operations, it also said that it's basically ready to expand its humanitarian actions dealing with the new creation of the Civil Military Coordination Center, a base now that has been set up in the occupied territories, seen as a transition with the U.S. military allegedly meant to oversee aid distribution and the so-called rebuilding of Gaza, part of that Trump plan. Your thoughts about this? I mean, we have seen, as I said, thousands of people were killed on their watch, and now they're saying we're suspending this, but we're waiting for basically bigger and better things to be able to help, so-called help the Palestinians in Gaza even more.
Well, what we are seeing is history repeats itself. As I said, once as a farce, once as tragedy. But history is repeating itself. You know, in 1920, the League of Nations gave a mandate to Palestine, to the British Empire. And now the United Nations has given a mandate to the American Empire for Palestine, for the West Bank, for the Gaza Strip. And the Gaza GHF basically was a test model for this mandate. They are refining it to implement basically an international U.S.-led oversight of the local people against the wishes of the local people. And of course, they don't want the local people to have any agency, and they want the local people to just do whatever they ask them to do, including disappear and die without any resistance. This is the plan, and this is the Trump plan, basically supported by Netanyahu, of course, and his government, this regime here, who could not win in Gaza, could not advance by military force. It could only, you know, win the destruction of the people of Gaza and the landscape of Gaza, but could not win against the resistance. They want now Trump and the U.S. administration to achieve what they failed militarily to achieve it via what they will project as a political solution. They even call it a peace plan. I don't know where the peace comes from. Israel kills on average two children every day during the so-called ceasefire for almost a month now. So what you see on your screen is basically what needs to be done. Israel and the U.S. should be taken to international courts for violations of basic human rights, for war crimes, crimes against humanity. They should be subjected to sanctions, boycotts, divestments. That's the way we must go.
All right. Well, what about that, Mick? You heard what Mazen said. Do you think that the responsible parties will be held responsible, will be held accountable? Because when we're looking at, of course, the Israeli entity and the Americans with the GHF in this, we also see the privatization and weaponization of aid in general. At the end of the day, are any of these entities going to be held responsible, your perspective?
You know, I like to think I can, in a shadowy way, see what the options are going forward. But on this one, I honestly don't know. The ICC in the past tried war criminals, but they were all black, apart from the Serbians, because any war criminals operating on behalf of the NATO powers were completely immune. Nobody dreamt of trying Kissinger, for example. So, but the case that the ICJ and the ICC has accepted against Israel and against Netanyahu, they accepted them because if they hadn't, the whole structure would have collapsed. It would have not just been very partisan and very unfair and only trying some war criminals and exempting others, which has always been the case, but it would have been seen around the world that genociders had nothing to fear from the ICJ or the ICC. So they had to initiate a process, and the South African government bravely stepped up there to the plate, and I think 14 other governments are supporting them. But where is the power? Where is the police that will enforce a judgment from the ICJ and the ICC? The only country in the world, as far as I know, found guilty by the ICJ for terrorism was the USA. They were actually found guilty when Nicaragua brought a case against them. But America just ignored it and continued to carry out remorseless massacres across the whole of Central America. So they didn't give a fig for that decision. So looking forward, your question is a fundamental question, but I cannot answer it. Nothing leads me to believe that these structures will actually enforce sanctions against the genociders, because they've never done so in the past. What they can do is, if they make a ruling, they can stimulate civil society to take action. We saw the Docker strikes and the riots and demonstrations in Italy recently in support of the Palestinian people and against their regime, which is very pro-Israel. We see in some places in America, we see dock workers for many years have refused to unload any Israeli ships. So we see the possibility of defeating them, but that defeat will not come from these official structures. It will not come from our governments who are complicit, who are making money, who completely agree with the genocide. Why would America not support Israeli genocide? America's born from genocide. Smallpox blankets, extermination of the native people. It's natural for the elites there to have sympathy with their latter-day acolytes. So I don't think any hope can come from there. But hope can come when people begin to speak Italian in the sense of the recent riots and strikes. And that can defeat Israel and will defeat Israel.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Mazen Qomsai, a university professor, historian and author out of Bethlehem. Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different Quranic concepts and Islamic teachings pertaining to humanity. And a couple of previous episodes, we started covering a very good book in this regard, which is titled A 250-Year-Old Person, which is a combination of different lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, covering the biographies and the lifestyle and the seerah of the Prophet of Islam Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and the great leaders of Islamic Ummah from his pure progeny. So by covering the lifestyle and the lessons from the life of these great leaders, we get to know more about Islamic standards and Islamic virtues, teachings about or of humanity. So we talked about the Battle of Trench. We were talking about the challenges posed by the Jewish community in Medina and the greatest treason and betrayal that they displayed during the time of the Battle of the Trench. As you know, the Battle of Trench was a very intense battle or situation for Muslim community in Medina. So the army of pagans, they were very huge army, including, covering different people from different tribes. And the other name for it is Battle of Ahzab, confederates. Actually, there is this surah in the Holy Quran, this chapter titled Ahzab, which covers some of the stories of this battle. And إِذْ جَاءُكُمْ مِنْ فَوْقِكُمْ, when they came to you from above and from below, and وَإِذْ ذَاقَتِ الْقُلُوبُ, and when بَلَغَتِ الْقُلُوبُ الْحَنَاجِرُ, when the hearts came to your throat, it was so intense that وَزُلْزِلُوا هُنَالِكَ ابْتُلِيَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ, it was a time that believers went through a great test. وَزُلْزِلُوا زَلْزَالًا, like the shaking of a sift, that you try to filter, or wind sifting, that you try to take away those people with shallow and with light faith, and you keep those with heavy faith. So it was a situation like this, that many people started to doubt, and some of them even showed their hypocrisy. Munafiqun, they started to spread fear and scaring people. They would even mock the Prophet ﷺ. Because with the addition of the treason and betrayal of the Jewish community of Banu Qurayza, at the middle of the highest level of war, what they did was that they said, okay, now from the other side of Medina, Muslims have stopped the pagans, army of pagans, by the trench. Back, they, because in back of them, it was the castles of Banu Qurayza. So they had this peace of mind that, okay, from back we are safe because we have the charter of Medina, we are in a treaty with these people, that we are all in Medina, we should defend each other. But then they realized, no, the Jewish community of Banu Qurayza, they are trying to make connection with the pagans and try to attack Muslims from behind. And they had left their families, women and children, alone in the city. So the Prophet sent some people to Medina to guard the houses and the families. And then people in the army, they were so afraid, some of them, so scared, that the munafiqun, the hypocrites, started mocking the Prophet. Because the Prophet had promised his community that you're going to get Kasra and Qaisar, you're going to get the greatest empires of that time, Persian Empire and Roman Empire. And they would say, you know what? He's promising you to get those empires, but you cannot even get your own houses. So they started scaring people and also mocking the Prophet. But then the Prophet did not lose hope and did not lose his, because he trusted in the promise of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We're going to have a break and we're going to come back.
اللهم صل على محمد المصطفى اللهم صل على محمد المصطفى
Welcome back. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the story of the Battle of Trench and the treason of the Banu Qurayza. So once it took place, the treason and betrayal, and at the middle of the war, somehow the Prophet ﷺ could contain the problem, contain the threat posed by Banu Qurayza. When the war finished, and the pagan army realized that they don't have a chance with Muslims, and they retreated, they went back to Mecca, Immediately after that, the Prophet went to the castles of Banu Qurayza and he told them, okay, this is betrayal according to all the standards. What shall we do with you? So he offered them, the Prophet offered them to choose a judge from among the companions of the Prophet. Okay, if you want, it's up to you. Choose any companion that you like to be the judge and tell me what to do with you. And then they themselves chose Sa'd bin Mu'adh. And Sa'd said, okay, based on the biblical standards, based on the Old Testament, the Torah, your book, according to your book, treason at the time of war is punished by this, that the male and mature male members of the community should be killed and then the other should be enslaved. And he said, according to your own standards, we deal you with your own standards. But there are different historical reports. Actually, there is a big thing that some Orientalists, some anti-Islam people have created over this. And there are some contradictory narratives about what exactly took place. What I'm trying to say is, even in the most problematic scenario, that Sa'd bin Mu'adh killed all the male members, still, the logic behind that was that, first of all, it has been issued, the verdict has been issued by a person they themselves chose. And again, it was based on their own teachings in their own scripture. Nevertheless, you have historians who would say that the whole story of killing all the male members of this tribe is a fabrication later on made by some of the rulers in the Islamic Ummah, who, according to the Shia Islam, were not infallible. They had problems, and because they wanted to justify their own cruelty, they needed to create something in the seerah of the Prophet to justify their own cruelty and to their own ruthless killing of other, like, for example, Hajjaj and other people who ruled Muslim Ummah, unfortunately, in different times, and they were cruel and they were ruthless. So they needed a kind of ideological background to justify their own unjust rule. So this is another analysis that is there that would say those narratives, those narrations telling us that all the male members were killed, they are later fabrications. Anyways, what happened was that Prophet ﷺ could manage the challenge of Banu Qurayza, whether by expelling them all or by that narrative of the killing by the verdict issued by Sa'd bin Mu'adh. Inshallah, we're going to continue the discussion about how the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam overcame other challenges on his way to build a Muslim community, inshallah, in the next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Bazaar.
Iran is associated with many things. If you are into geology, that would be oil oozing out of the land. Iran is among the world's top five in oil reserves. But oil or petroleum is not the only mineral resource that makes the country rich. Copper is among its other riches, as are lead and zinc.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of Bazaar. In case you didn't know, Iran has over 220 million tons of proven zinc and lead ore reserves. That is significant. But in copper, it has stood among the top 10. What is being done about all that treasure? It can't all stay underground forever. And there are those extracting and producing the minerals. To meet some of them, we made a trek to Zadin Industrial and Mining Group.
In 2009, Iran produced 383,000 tons of copper, meaning it had the world's ninth largest reserves of copper at 32.5 million tons. As a matter of fact, the mines at Sarcheshme in Kerman province contain the world's second largest load of copper ore, that is 5% of the world's total in 2009. Iran is one of the most important mineral producers in the world, ranking among 15 major mineral-rich countries. It was estimated to hold some 68 types of minerals, 37 billion tons of proven reserves, and more than 57 billion tons of potential reserves worth $770 billion in 2014.
That is not to say mining in Iran has no more work to be done on it. It is still under development, but there are plenty of doers in this country, and plenty more are waiting for further opportunity to arise for their turn at investment. Zarin Group has already arrived at a point to claim we have done what we could.
Flotation, or in other words, ore dressing in mineral processing, is a main process of production. It is a method used to separate and concentrate ores by altering their surfaces to a hydrophobic or hydrophilic condition. These chemical and physical changes to the surface of minerals are made using materials with different properties, including activators.
Now, in working with minerals, the production process is most efficiently carried out in stages. And what a company just cannot do without is its laboratory for pilot tests before going head in with its whole stock. It is literally to avoid the proverbial haste that makes waste.
An asset to corporations is their R&D departments. The reason is they perform research for technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones, hence elevating the company's industrial standing.
Indeed, standard is everything, especially for foreign trade. And Iran's production, by far outweighing its domestic use, there is plenty of room for mineral exports from this country. The industry is export-oriented, as a matter of fact, according to Mr. Katkhodayi.
Only 80 to 100,000 tons of produced zinc ingots and 50 to 80,000 tons of lead ingots are consumed domestically. And the remaining were exported to target markets in Asia and Europe, going by 2014 and 2015 estimates. The National Iranian Copper Industries Company is one of the largest companies listed on the Tehran Stock Exchange. It was the largest non-oil exporter in Iran in 2010, with exports worth $1.3 billion. All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there on the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
Right now, millions of them are right on your skin, in your mouth, on your teeth, in your gut. They're everywhere. They can control your mind and they can control your mood. You heard me right. I'm talking about bacteria. And as terrifying as that might sound, because, you know, naturally you would think of these microorganisms as harmful little things that cause disease, you shouldn't really panic. You're fine. In fact, there are a lot more good bacteria in our body than bad bacteria.
Bacteria have got a bad reputation, and for good reason. Bacteria can cause pneumonia, meningitis, food poisoning, and a variety of other infections and diseases. These bad bacteria are the reason why we diligently disinfect our hands and wipe down places where germs tend to congregate, and we have not stopped there. To kill these bad microorganisms, we have developed a wide range of antibiotics. But this is not the whole picture. Our bodies are also home to an estimated 100 trillion good bacteria. They are essential to our survival and live in complete harmony with us humans.
It's a symbiotic relationship in which we both benefit, us humans and them good bacteria. It's called mutualism. Think of bees and flowers.
Bees fly from flower to flower to drink the sugary sweet nectar that is made by flowers. While drinking the nectar, bees get some pollen on their hairy bodies, and when they land on the next flower, some of the pollen will rub off their body and pollinate the plant. In this mutualistic relationship, the bees get to eat and the flowering plants get to reproduce. Similarly enough, we help good bacteria eat and thrive, and they in turn help our bodies digest food and absorb nutrients. They are also effective in preventing and treating conditions like obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and inflammations associated with autoimmune diseases.
The bacteria that I'm going to be talking about in this week's feature program are primarily present in our digestive system and in some foods and supplements. You've probably heard their name, probiotics. In order to learn how these probiotic supplements and products are made right here in Iran, I'm visiting a pharmaceutical company called Zistahmi. Here's more.
Actually, I should go back to around 20 years back when we started to think about probiotics in Iran. At that time, probiotic was a really very low profile subject in Iran. Nobody or a few people, even the physicians, did know about the benefits of probiotics. We started working in the University of Tehran, working as a thesis of students, and after a few years we established this company, Zistahmir, in the incubator center of the College of Pharmacy. And after 5 years, we could manage to establish this prestigious building and production facility outside in the outskirts of Tehran.
This is the storage room that houses a wide variety of raw materials that are used in the manufacturing process. There are various aisles and many shelves here. There's also a map locating everything. But the effective material, microbes, are not and cannot be kept in any ordinary storage room. Certain probiotic strains are stored at extremely low temperatures and in special freezers to avoid any kind of contamination. These microbial strains are then grown. This is called fermentation. At the end of this process, a broth is made which contains a large number of probiotic organisms. Because this broth is in dilute form, it should be concentrated. That's when centrifugation comes into play and turns the broth into a cream-like substance. The paste is then spray-dried. The production of probiotics is a complex procedure and requires extensive skill and experience. Quality control is essential throughout the whole production process, from raw materials to the final product. Zistahmir is equipped with different laboratories and control rooms to ensure each stage in the production process is systematically controlled, high standards are met, and objectives are pursued.
At the moment, hopefully, Iran is very advanced in terms of probiotic products. I think that at the moment we have around 10 companies which are producing probiotics. And of course, because we have been the first company, we have a main market share in, comparing to other competitors in this field. So the probiotic industry in Iran is deeply rooted, we don't need to import any products or intermediate, anything from the outside.
The development of formulations requires extensive research on the best combination of strains. This is an ongoing process that keeps evolving by the day. Various research teams are at work to find new and more effective combinations. Depending on the indication, different probiotic strains are chosen and tested on their compatibility. In addition to the API, active pharmaceutical ingredients, research teams consider including other ingredients in the formulation, namely prebiotics, which are a type of fiber that human body cannot digest but serves as food for probiotics. Back to the clean room. These products are very expensive. Thus, by producing them inside Iran, the country can save a lot of money. And with that, I want to conclude my report of yet another company located in Pardis Technology Park.
And that wraps up our program for today. Stay tuned next week for another edition of Bazaar.
Thank you.